Ecclesiastes chapter 10 this evening. And while you're turning there, any of the finance committee members that are here tonight, I'd like to see you back in the fellowship hall when we're done this evening, just for a couple minutes. So finance committee right after our Bible study tonight. Last week, as we were looking at the end of chapter 9 and through the first verse of chapter 10, we're looking at what Solomon had to say about the vulnerability of wisdom, in the sense that wisdom is obviously better than foolishness, but it doesn't necessarily guarantee success or even a good reputation. He gave a little story there in verses 13 through 16 of how a wise man saved the city, and yet he wasn't recognized afterwards. And so he just speaks to that. And then you come to chapter 10 and verses 2 through 7. We just started that last week, the impediments to wisdom. And we said last week, verse 2, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left. The right was the place of honor. The left was the place of that which was inferior. And so he's simply saying wisdom is superior to foolishness. Verse 3, yea, also, when he that is a fool walks by the way, his wisdom fails him, and he says to everyone that he is a fool. Basically just saying that a fool can't hide his foolishness. He comes out of the house, and right away his words and his actions reveal what he really is, and that is a fool. I'm reminded, and I read verse 3 there, I'm reminded too of what Paul says in Romans, speaking of mankind professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. A fool doesn't know that he's a fool. And he comes out of the house and his words and actions reveal to everyone else that he's a fool, but he doesn't realize it. He doesn't know it. And mankind as a whole, because they have rejected God and because they were not thankful in Romans chapter 1, says they profess themselves to be wise, but they became fools. Then verse 4, and that's, we kind of left off with verse 3 last week. So we'll pick up with verse 4. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against you, leave not your place, for yielding pacifies great offenses. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against you, and basically talking about anger, if the ruler gets angry with you, how do you respond? And this really is kind of not just with reference to a ruler, but how do we respond to anger in general? I think there's a lesson here in this verse on how to respond to anger. Specifically, he's talking about if the ruler gets angry with you, he's probably making reference to those who were of the king's counselors. And you and the king gets angry at you as one of his advisors. How should you respond? But again, I think there's a very general statement here. How do we respond to anger? He says, how you respond, leave not your place. Again, as it relates to a king's advisor, a king's counselor, leave not your place, don't leave your post. In other words, the idea is don't leave in a huff. Don't make a rash, hasty departure. You may regret that rash, hasty departure. And kind of the idea, don't you respond to anger with anger, kind of that idea of I'm going to take my toys and go home. Don't leave your place. Don't make a rash decision. How many times have people actually lost their jobs because their boss got mad at them and they felt that they were being unfairly treated by the boss, and so in a rash decision, they leave, they go home, and they lose their job. And so that's kind of the thought here. Don't leave your place, for yielding pacifies great offenses. King James says yielding, your translation may say composure pacifies offenses, or even calmness. A soft answer turns away wrath, as Solomon himself said in Proverbs. And here it's the idea of you keep your composure. It can pacify the anger of the person who's angry. Even if you have been wrong, maybe you have offended the other person and they have gotten angry, don't make a rash, hasty departure. Stay calm, keep your composure, and you'll probably be able to pacify the one who's angry, even if you were in the wrong. As I thought about that, even within a marriage, husband and wife get to arguing and fighting, and this is a good response. Don't huff off in anger. Keep your composure. Remain calm. And more than likely, within a very short time, things will be calmed down, pacified, and everything will be all right. Where we get in trouble when we respond with anger to anger, it just feeds the anger, even in a marriage or whatever anger. As we respond in anger, it just feeds the anger, and before long, you're just butting heads. And so this is, again, specifically referring to a ruler, but I think in general, it's a very good thought. Any questions or comments on that? I think it's pretty much understandable. We know that, again, soft answer turns away wrath. We know that proverb. As most of you know, I do a lot of marriage counseling, and that verse is a great verse just even for marriage counseling. Because all of the fighting and arguing that takes place when there's problems in a marriage, and many times the one, they feel like they're justified in their anger because the other person started it. And I tell them over and over and over again, a reaction of anger is just as sinful as the initial action of anger. We normally don't look at it that way. We think if the person's mad first, then I have a right to be mad at them. And if they started the argument, I have a right to keep the argument going. And that's not true at all. A reaction of anger is just as sinful as the initial anger. And in essence, that's what Solomon's saying, don't respond in anger, and you can pacify the offense. Verses 5 through 7 kind of go together here. Again, he speaks of the ruler in verse 4, and he continues with that thought. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceeds from the ruler. So he's talking again about the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low places. In essence, he's saying a ruler who raises up the one who's a fool, but puts down the one who's wise. He says here that folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low places. The contrast there is rich in wisdom. So we've got the foolish one, and the one who's rich in wisdom. And the foolish one is raised up to a place of prominence, and the wise one is put down. Sometimes a ruler may do that because he himself, in his own pride, wants to put down others so that he can stand out above them. And so he'll raise up the foolish and put down the wise because he fears the wise. And Solomon says that's an evil which he has seen under the sun. And I think we would all agree that we have seen that, where even a president will be fearful of the wise and will raise an incompetent person to a place of prominence out of fear of the wise. And verse 7, kind of the same idea, I have seen servants upon horses and princes walking like servants upon the earth. That same idea of keeping down the wise and exalting the incompetent. Not that Solomon could look into the future as such, but you do have to kind of wonder, and we've pointed this out a couple of times in this study of Ecclesiastes, did he see something in his son Rehoboam that caused him to say some of the things he said? Because verses 5 through 7 really describe Rehoboam, his son. When Solomon died, Rehoboam became king. And remember, the northern tribes said to Rehoboam, you need to remove the heavy burden that your father has put upon us. And if you do, we will serve you. But if you don't, we will rebel. And so Rehoboam got advice from Solomon's counselors, the aged ones, and then he got advice from his peers, the young ones. And the young ones said, don't remove the burden that your father put on. In fact, make the burden heavier. Who did Rehoboam follow? He followed the foolish rather than the wise. And the kingdom was divided. And so again, not that Solomon could look into the future as such, but you wonder, did he see in Rehoboam some propensity to the very thing he's saying here in verses 5 through 7?
Yeah. God-given wisdom may have given him foresight.
Solomon had wisdom, and he, in his observance of life that we're reading about here, he may have observed his son Rehoboam and his actions and maybe could foresee some of that. Foolishness on his son's part. Other questions or comments? As we come to verses 7 through 11, we have six illustrations of foolishness. They're proverbs, really. And here Solomon, as he's going through this search for meaning in life, here in chapter 10, he now is kind of getting into some proverbs. They sound very similar to some of the proverbs that we have in our book of Proverbs. But it really is dealing with illustrations of foolishness. Verse 8, he that digs a pit shall fall into it. Whoso breaks an hedge, a serpent shall bite him. Whoso removes stones, shall be hurt therewith. And he that splits wood shall be endangered thereby. If the iron be blunt and he do not whet the edge, then must he put forth more strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct. Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. Six illustrations. We'll kind of break this down a little bit. Number one, in verse 8, he that digs a pit shall fall into it. I think basically the idea is a fool's own actions may prove to be his undoing. You dig a ditch and you fall into it. Sometimes a fool, he'll do something very foolish, and it will be his undoing. And so he's just giving an illustration of foolishness. Even in digging a pit, wisdom is necessary. He's pointing out here how foolishness can be the undoing of a person in contrast to wisdom. Whoso breaks an hedge, a serpent shall bite him. I think he's talking really here about tearing down a stone wall, and probably within a stone wall, there's going to be some snakes. So you start tearing down a stone wall, and you're going to get bit with a snake. Again, a man's foolishness will unleash hidden dangers, is kind of the thought there. As you proceed in foolishness, you're going to probably uncover some things that is going to be very dangerous to you. So he's speaking of foolishness and giving simple illustrations of the contrast between foolishness and wisdom. Before you tear down a stone wall, you need to use some wisdom so that you don't get bit with a snake. But a fool's just going to rush in and tear down the wall and get bit. And so wisdom is necessary. A man's foolishness will unleash hidden dangers. Whoso removes stones shall be hurt therewith. Probably here, speaking of working in a stone quarry, and as you're working in a stone quarry, obviously there's inherent danger. You could drop a stone on your foot or on your leg. There's inherent danger in working in a stone quarry. And so he's simply, again, saying wisdom's necessary. And even in the simplest task, wisdom is necessary. And as you work in a stone quarry, you're producing these rocks, which back in those days, rocks were used for a lot of things in building and so forth. And so you were producing these rocks for building, and yet that which you were producing is the very thing that was going to hurt you if you didn't use wisdom. Maybe an example of that, not with rocks per se, but the product of your own hands ends up being that which hurts you. And I think of this story in the book of Esther. Haman built a gallows for Mordecai. And who was hung on the gallows? The product of your own hands ends up being the very thing that hurts you. Again, Haman was a fool. And so foolishness many times leads to that hurt. In verse 9, he that splits wood shall be endangered thereby. Kind of the same idea. Again, splitting wood, there's inherent danger in that. If you don't use good wisdom, you're going to be hurt by it. You know, if you don't use good wisdom, the wood's going to split and hurt you, or the axe head's going to fall off and hit you. Whatever. You've got to make sure that you're using wisdom. So that's just in those four examples, the idea is you've got to have wisdom or you're going to be hurt. Foolishness will hurt you. As he speaks of this splitting of wood in verse 9, he kind of goes on into verse 10 with that same thought. If the iron be blunt and he do not whet the edge, then must he put forth more strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct. He's speaking of splitting of wood, and then he says, if you don't have a sharp axe, you're going to have to put a lot more work into it. In other words, a fool will work himself to death if he doesn't prepare ahead of time. Wisdom prepares ahead of time. Wisdom will take a look at what needs to be done and will make the proper preparations. A fool will just head into it without any preparation at all. And he'll have to work a whole lot harder to accomplish anything. But if wisdom prepares, it'll be successful. And in the last part of verse 10 there, it says, but wisdom is profitable to direct. Your translation may say something like this, has the advantage of giving success. In other words, if you prepare ahead, you've got an advantage that you're going to succeed. But if you don't prepare ahead, you're going to work a lot harder and accomplish nothing. Again, just a proverb, a wise proverb for just practical living under the sun, as Solomon is emphasizing here. As he speaks of proper preparation, being wise and being advantageous for success, he does then say in verse 11 that even applying wisdom doesn't guarantee success if it's not applied at the right time. Surely the serpent will bite with enchantment, and the babbler is no better. He's talking about a snake charmer, and that's mentioned elsewhere in Scripture. And I don't know, again, if your translation may say something along this line, if the snake bites before it is charmed, this is no advantage to the charmer. If the snake bites before it is charmed, there is no advantage to the charmer. In other words, a charmer will charm the snake so that the snake doesn't bite you. But if the snake already has bitten you, what good is the charmer? Okay? That's kind of the thought of what he's saying here. And what he's saying is, if you can kind of think of the proverb, if you don't apply wisdom at the right time, you're going to get bit. So wisdom in itself is advantageous and can give you success, but if it's applied at the wrong time, it's too late. Wisdom applied too late doesn't accomplish what you wanted it to accomplish. You can still end up being a fool if you don't apply wisdom at the right time, just as a snake charmer. If he doesn't charm the snake at the right time, he gets bit. A wise man that's not exercising wisdom at the right time is going to get bit with his foolishness. That make sense? Any questions or comments? Again, these are just pretty basic proverbs. You have to, at first you read it and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but as you think it through, it really makes good sense what he's saying. So he's talking about wisdom as compared to foolishness. Foolishness will hurt you. Wisdom will give you success, but you're going to have to apply that wisdom at the right time. That's kind of a summary of those verses. Any questions or comments? As he speaks here of the snake charmer, if you will, he now kind of transitions into into words, and primarily the words of a fool. A snake charmer is one who charms the snake, while a fool will try to charm with his words. But he kind of transitions into the, in these verses 8 through 11 kind of have been dealing with the actions of a fool. And now we come to verse 12, and the next 12 through 15, he's dealing with the words of a fool. And he makes that transition with this image of a snake charmer. And so he says in verse 12, "The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself." The words of a wise man are gracious. They are pleasing. They are persuasive words. They are words that gain favor. That's the words of a wise man. I would say, too, in light of what he just said in verse 11, a wise man's words are gracious in their timing. The right word spoke at the right time is a very gracious word. And so I think he's talking about persuasive, pleasing words spoken at the right time is from a wise man. A fool will speak before he thinks, and it will be his undoing. But the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. If you speak before thinking, oftentimes that will be your undoing. It'll get you in all kinds of trouble. And so that's what he's saying here. I read this one time. It was actually a preacher in his prayer said this: "Make my words sweet, for I may have to eat them." Now that's pretty good. That's a pretty good thought. Make my words sweet because I may have to eat them. And that's in essence what he's saying here. A wise man, his words are gracious, but a fool, it'll be his undoing. Verse 13, again, continuing with the words of a fool, "The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness," or evil madness, or wicked madness, your translation may say. Begins as foolishness, ends in evil or wicked madness. Pretty much self-explanatory, and as he goes on to verse 14, begins as foolishness, but as he continues to talk, it ends up in evil madness or wicked madness. Because, in verse 14, a fool also is full of words. In other words, a fool just keeps talking. Starts out as foolishness, but as he keeps talking, he multiplies his words, and it ends up in evil, wicked madness. And so he says in verse 14, a fool also is full of words, or a fool multiplies words. A man cannot tell what shall be. See, a fool, as he multiplies words, will begin to talk about things he has no idea what he's talking about. He won't shut up because he just keeps talking. He thinks he knows, but in reality, he knows nothing. And so he's saying here, a fool will multiply his words, but a man cannot tell what shall be. We don't know what the future is, and yet a fool will presume that he does know the future. And as he multiplies words, he begins to talk about things that he doesn't really know. And in fact, says a man cannot tell what shall be, and what shall be after him, who can tell him? In other words, he does not consider the consequences of his words. A fool does not consider the consequences of his words. What's going to happen after he does shut up? And he doesn't even consider that. He doesn't consider his consequences. And then verse 15, the labor of the foolish wearies every one of them because he knows not how to go to the city. What in the world does that mean? Doesn't know how to go to the city. The labor of the foolish wearies every one of them. A fool works until his strength is exhausted without accomplishing anything. That's in essence what he's saying here. He will work until his strength is exhausted without accomplishing anything. Why? Because, as he said earlier, he didn't prepare ahead of time. He really doesn't know what he's doing. He really doesn't necessarily even know where he wants to end up. And so he's spinning his wheels. He's using all kinds of energy, but he really is not accomplishing anything because he hasn't thought it through. And where he says here, he does not know how to go to the city, probably that was a kind of a saying like maybe we would use today, he doesn't know enough to get in out of the rain. Kind of that idea. Doesn't even know how to go to town. Doesn't even know how to go to the city. Probably was a phrase used to refer to extreme foolishness, extreme stupidity. And he says, here's a man that he works and wearies himself, expending all kinds of strength and energy, but accomplishing nothing because he is a fool. He's just an extreme stupidity. He doesn't even know how to go to town. Doesn't know enough to get in out of the rain, is kind of what he's saying. Yeah. Too foolish to ask for directions. Yeah, that may be part of it. Don't go there, Gail. whose side are you on? Make me look bad. Does anyone have any other comments? Again, these are proverbs from the man who wrote the book of Proverbs, really. And when you really stop and look at them, they're kind of self-explanatory, but it just takes a little thought to see what is he really saying here. And trying to show the works of a fool, the words of a fool, and how that in both they accomplish nothing good. And wisdom will prepare ahead of time and will use gracious words and will be successful because there'll be actions and words given at the right time with good purpose in mind. It's been planned out ahead of time. Any other thoughts? Questions? We'll end there because if we get into the next section, we can't stop in the middle of it. So we'll pick up there. Actually, next week is our vacation Bible school. We'll pick up in 2 weeks at verse 16. Let's bow in prayer. Father, thank you again for this time together. Remind us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And we must start there. A fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. And I pray, Father, that we would live our lives knowing that you are in control and that we will indeed fear you, we will reverence you, we will respect you, we will live our lives in the knowledge of you rather than living our lives as if there is no God. And Father, as believers, certainly we believe in a God. We believe there is a God, and yet how often we live our lives as if there is no God. We go our own way, we do our own thing, we just make decisions based upon how we feel and what we want, and truly living our lives as if there is no God in such foolishness. Help us to be wise in our ways to acknowledge you and allow you to direct our paths. And it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.